This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue-collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue-collar workers for blue-collar workers. Workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies and hats for both men and women, Trollco represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Trollco has your back, literally. Head to trollco.com/hunting. That's trollco.com/hunting and enter the discount code Empire25 for 25% off of your first order. Trollco, for the hardworking American.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Sierra has all the best active and outdoor brands for the super athletic stuff, like running gear for cruising up the trail. Woo! And the super athlete-ish stuff, like fishing gear for chilling by the creek. Nice cast. Fitness apparel to push for higher reps. You got this. And golf balls priced so you can afford to lose one. Or a few. Head to Sierra or Sierra.com for the brands you want at the prices that let you do it all. From athletic to athlete-ish, Sierra's got it.
5 a.m., I'm up with a crisp Celsius energy drink. Running 12 miles today. Grab a green juice, quick change, and head to work. Meetings, workshops, one more Celsius, no slowing down. Working late, but obviously still meeting the girls for a little dancing. Celsius, live, fit, go. Grab a cold, refreshing Celsius at your local retailer or locate now at Celsius.com.
Spring break isn't what it used to be. It's better. This spring, stay 3 nights and get a $50 Best Western gift card. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Visit BestWestern.com for complete terms and conditions.
President's Day savings are happening now at the Home Depot with up to 40% off select appliances. Looking to upgrade your fridge? Check out LG's newest model, serving up ice in all kinds of styles. Cube, crushed, craft ice, and now new mini craft ice straight from the dispenser. From cold brew to fizzy favorites, these refrigerators will have you entertaining like a pro. Shop President's Day savings and get up to 40% off, plus free delivery on select appliances like LG at the Home Depot. Free delivery on appliance purchases of $1,498 or more. Offer valid February 5th through the 25th, U.S. only. See store online for details.
Welcome to the Migration Podcast, your guide for waterfowl hunting tactics, gear, and conservation. And now, your host, Brian Hallblyde.
What is up, everyone? As John A.M. said, I'm your host, Brian Hallblyde. I really appreciate you taking time out of your day to tune in to the Migration Waterfowl Podcast. Thank you so much. This episode is brought to you by the Duck Hole & Company, Attracting Feathers Together. They are a full-service habitat company located in North Carolina. If you have questions about waterfowl habitat or need some work done on your property, contact them through any of their social media platforms at the Duck Hole Company. They can also fix you up with Golden Millet, the Duck Buffet, and the best bang for your duck. Well, I'm fired up here today. We're getting into June now, and we're only 3 months away from the early teal season. How exciting is that? It's hard to believe how quick time passes. You know, it seems like sometimes at work the days are dragging on and the shifts are dragging on and they never move as quick as you like. Not that you're ever wishing your life away, but it's exciting to be one day closer to duck season, and we're about 3 months away from early teal season, and that's going to be coming up on us very, very quickly here. So just trying to get some projects done around here, trying to keep up with my gear. I got the kayak just about all ready to go. I got it mostly painted. I'd like to put a coat on the underside. I got the Northern Flight kayak blind installed, retrofitted. I think that's going to work out pretty nice. Took advantage of another off-season sale that Rogers was having. I picked up a dozen of Final Approach Last Pass mallard floaters, decoys. They had them on sale for $60, which was a hell of a deal. I also picked up a 12-slot duck decoy bag, also Final Approach Last Pass model, for $25. And then I needed a motion decoy bag. Rogers makes a nice 4-slot motion decoy bag, and that was on sale for $39.99. So did pretty well, I think, for and then they had a $15 off coupon that I was able to use also. So just over $100 for a dozen decoys, 12-slot decoy bag, and a 4-slot motion decoy bag. So pretty sweet. Saved a bunch of money. Got some stuff that I needed for this upcoming season. And just kind of going through my gear, practicing my calling, trying to make sure that I'm ready to rock and roll once the season rolls around. And haven't had much time to work on the bass boat project. I'm going to be turning that into kind of a fishing boat / bow fishing / duck hunting boat. It's been a pretty wet spring here in Western Pennsylvania, so haven't had a whole lot of days to work outside. I don't have a whole lot of space, covered space, that I can work on that boat. So got to wait for the nicer days. Can probably clean out my garage. I think it might be deep enough, but my wife and I both park our cars in there and try to keep that truck inside. You know, she's going on 11 years old. So I think it helps tremendously, especially living in the salt belt, where they salt these roads every winter, and giving that truck an opportunity to dry out and stay out of the weather, stay out of the sun, and just trying to keep her going for another 3 years so my youngest finishes college. It's not really the greatest time to be buying a vehicle. I mean, they're so expensive right now. Interest rates are crazy. Just trying to limp this thing along for, you know, I don't know. It's only at 130,000 miles, which isn't much for a vehicle these days, but you know, a lot of things can start happening. So especially if you're like me and you take your vehicle around the country every year to go hunting out west, it's nice to have something reliable and that you can count on to get you out there and back, and just focus on enjoying yourself instead of stressing about vehicle issues. Started having some issues with the, I don't know if it's a fuel system issue or hopefully not a transmission issue. It's been kind of jerky when you accelerate. The reason I'm thinking it's a fuel issue is because I had an error code. I've got a diagnostic scanner here, and it turned out to be the mass air inflow sensor was dirty. I cleaned that. It was getting really horrible gas mileage. Got that all cleaned out, and things seemed to be getting better. The gas mileage returned to where it normally was. But, yeah, I don't know what the issue is now. I'm not getting any error codes. So I don't know if that means there's just some bad sensors that aren't sending the right info or what, but I'm probably going to have to take it to my buddy's shop and see if we can chase down these gremlins and get everything worked out before I start driving out west, because I don't want to have that hanging over me. So, yeah, that's about it. Just trying to keep up with life around here. And you know how it goes when spring turns to summer and all the yard work starts and all the obligations for family and friend graduation parties and cookouts and 4th of July, Memorial Day get-togethers and things like that. Just trying to keep up with everything and keep my head above water. So I did record a episode for our YouTube channel for our Migration Monday. If you haven't checked that out yet, those are kind of a companion episode to this audio podcast. Basically, I'm just bringing you a second episode every week instead of just having to wait for the audio podcast to drop on Thursdays. We're putting out a video episode every Monday over there at the YouTube channel. This week, I discussed what all goes into planning an out-of-state hunt. As I mentioned before, I'm in the middle of planning a trip to Nebraska and Kansas to catch the early teal seasons. So I figured I'd share some of my tips for out-of-state hunting there, since it's kind of fresh in my mind. Been fortunate to be able to go travel out west and up into Canada a few times and learned a few things, made a few mistakes over the years, and hopefully some of the tips I picked up will help you if you want to, you know, plan your own out-of-state hunt sometime. So make sure you subscribe to the YouTube channel so you don't miss any of the latest uploads over there. Hit that like button on the videos. That helps us out tremendously as far as continuing to bring you free content. So let's talk about today's episode. I'm going to be talking with my friend Eric Long. Eric is the owner of Drumming Log Wildlife Management and a founding partner with the Deer Hunter Project. Eric grew up farming and hunting in Northeast Ohio. We discuss his education and progression as a wildlife manager. We also talk about how he ended up managing the largest inland marsh in the state of Ohio and his experiences over the years there. We also chat about the importance of moist soil management, drawing down in flooding areas, drone spraying and seeding, maintaining water control structures, and what role conserving wetlands plays in the ecosystem. Eric has been a good friend of mine over the years, and I've always enjoyed our conversations. I think you'll enjoy this one too. So let's get into episode 6. Welcome back to another episode of the Migration Waterfowl Podcast. I'm your host, Brian Halbly. I've got a special guest today. I've known of him for, had to be 10, 15 years since I've been part of the Quality Deer Management Association, which is now the NDA now, National Deer Association. He was a 2009 Manager of the Year through QDMA. It's a pretty prestigious award, very difficult to get considered for that, and he actually was a finalist for that. He's also a real estate agent who sold one of my farms for me. Big buck killer, rough grouse enthusiast, Mr. Eric Long. How are you today?
I'm doing good. Oh, boy. Yeah, jack of all trades. Apparently I don't have enough to do. Thanks for inviting me on. Looking forward to this conversation.
Yeah, this is going to be interesting because and I have come together over whitetail deer and other conservation projects over the last decade or so, but didn't really realize you were that much into waterfowl. And you know, you've got a long, not only personal, but employment history with working with waterfowl. And kind of doing something different here with the Migration Waterfowl podcast. So we got to talking one day and picking your brain and thought, well, heck, man, I didn't know you were this much into it.
Yeah, you can say. Yeah, it's, you know, you spend all your time with deer, you know, and actually, let me rewind. You know, I work at the biggest inland marsh in the state of Ohio. It's roughly 6,000 acres in size. And, you know, it's mostly a waterfowl area. And yeah, so it was, I was doing all this, you know, waterfowl stuff, ducks, geese, cranes, and, you know, other species. And the deer stuff was my escape in the beginning. And then that turned into a monster in itself. Now I'm ready to get back to the waterfowl, concentrate back on that again, you know, give my all to the species. But, yeah, I've been working with waterfowl on the management side for almost 28 years now.
That's managing impressive.
managing wetlands and stuff. And yeah, it's and especially where this wildlife area is located at. It's you know, there's a creek that basically tells us what we can do and what we can't do with flooding and stuff like that. So it's a nightmare. It can be at times, but no, waterfowl management is, it's not that complicated, but man, there's just, it's the ecosystem that evolves in waterfowl management, you know, wetland management, let's just call it that. Wow. It's a lot of stuff going on in, so 20, in a lot of critters.
So 28 years, you and I think we were both born in 1974.
Mm-hmm.
So 28 years of waterfowl management. That must mean we're getting old, buddy.
I just turned 50 last month.
Yep.
And I'm not liking it. I can tell you that right now.
I'm hanging on to my 40s until October. So I'm hanging by a thread. But
before
we get too deep into this, let's give the listeners a quick introduction of who you are, where you're from, and how you ended up here.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good question, Brian. No, but yeah, I guess start at the beginning there. Yeah, like Brian said, Eric Long. I wear many, 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 many hats, and sometimes too many hats. I work for a state agency and for 28 years, and started Drummond Log Wildlife Management back in 2001, managing people's properties for white-tailed deer, traveling all over the country doing that. And then that, you know, last, I think, four or five years ago, Mr. Cody Altizer and I, he's a videographer, photographer, we hooked up. He's a client, dear client of mine, how he started out. And we created this entity called the Deer Hunter Project, where we started out trying to educate sportsmen that, you know what, we have a shelf life. If we don't turn our act around and start taking conservation seriously. And then we did some short films, and then that led to a podcast, a Deer Hunter podcast. And we had a gentleman on with the Rough Grouse Society. And again, we just had him on for something, you know, we were interested in the grouse narrative. And then, you know, he was the president of the organization. And I don't know if it was Cody or myself asked, you know, hey, what is the future of the rough grouse? And he said, in some areas, zero. And when we got off the podcast, Cody and I, we talked, and it was like, not on our watch. So that led to this trying to save the grouse, and it's turned into this monster and, you know, all consumptive of my life and pretty much, you know, the consulting work, excuse me, as you know, I don't do as much as I would like or I used to because of, you know, trying to save the world, you know, whatever. But yeah, so, and as Brian said, I do dabble in real estate with Mossy Oak Properties as well here in Ohio. And yeah, so family, husband, yes. So I try to, yeah, the deer thing is, I still love climbing in a tree stand on that fall day.
Sure.
With your bow. It's hard to beat. But now my love and my passion anymore is following an English setter named Waylon around, that world is so welcoming, if you get around a bunch of bird people, now they can get a little snotty with people, their dogs and their breeding and stuff. But the upland community is so welcoming. I know Cody and I, we did a seminar for Pheasants Forever back in 2020 before the COVID outbreak in Minneapolis. And, we've never been to a convention and all that stuff. And it's just like any other conventions, lots of people and dogs. And it was just so eye-opening, where there was like no narcissism, no, hey, look at me. It was just like, hey, where you bird hunt? Here's some points, waypoints for you to go to Michigan. You're like, what? Like, what? What? This is awesome. But so that's the quick and dirty version of what I do and, what's the direction that I'm heading right now. So
you decided to, what kind of pushed you into getting yourself educated to work in the wildlife management sector?
Well, I tell you what, I think a lot of people's stories, how you grew up. And, I was very fortunate to live in Northeast Ohio in a county called Ashtabula, which was where I lived, was, 15, 20 minutes from Lake Erie and 15, 20 minutes from PA, both sportsmen's paradises. And I kind of, we had a little hobby farm growing up, and then, worked on farms. And I know my family, they were all in construction, and I knew that wasn't what I wanted to do. I loved being on a tractor and all that stuff. And I remember being in school and going into the guidance counselor, and there was a pamphlet said Hocking College on it. And I opened it up. I don't know why I did. I just grabbed it, and it was a school of natural resources. And I'm like, that's interesting. And read into it, went and visited a college. And it's like, this is it. This is awesome. This is what I want to do. And, back in the early 90s, the world of internet wasn't around, obviously. So, they groomed you and educated you to work for a state agency. And once I got my degree, I got, hired on with the state. And the funny thing is I took a credit class of wildland firefighting. And I took it just to fill credit up, so I can graduate. And next thing you know, I'm on a plane to Spokane, Washington, going to go fight forest fires I got hired on with a hotshot crew after I spent a summer out there fighting fire. I got hired on with the hotshot crew in the state agency at the same time. And my wife, we were dating at the time, and I kind of knew I was going to ask her to marry me, and I was assuming she would have said yes. So I chose the wildlife management aspect of it and headed for the division. So, but yeah, I was going to be a wildland firefighter. That was going to be my career. So
how much time?
How things are.
Yeah. How much time did you spend out west doing that?
I spent a whole summer. I think it was in 94, 95. I forget what it is. But yeah, I paid for college, spending, time out there. And that's another podcast in itself, the stories that I could tell you about that. And what's awesome is that my son is heading in the same direction. He went out west to fight forest fires. And I was really looking forward to 2 years ago to go out there with him, so we can do the father-son thing. And things happened where I couldn't. But I don't know, physically I could even do it anymore anyway, but those mountains are mountains, but he's into fire as well. Cause I had him on fire lines doing control burns since he was like, I don't know, probably too young to be on a fire line. And he's always been around control burns and fire and all this other stuff, doing and stuff. And I tell you what, I'm fortunate enough to be with some really talented people when we do burns. And there's nobody else I'd rather have on the line. I mean, we did a burn for a gentleman in Indiana, and we didn't bring our radios because he said he had radios. Well, he didn't have radios, and we got there, and we just knew each other enough to do this safely. It was amazing.
That's great.
Yeah, it was crazy. But I'm kind of getting off track here, but no, so that's that.
Yeah, I got a lot of respect for you and all the men and women that do that out west. My family and I went to Yosemite in California, I guess maybe 2-3 years ago. There was several huge forest fires going on. They actually had one of the redwood forest groves closed because the forest fire were too close, and we could actually see one of them burning on a ridge. And I couldn't imagine running into that or jumping into that. And just mad respect for you and all the guys that, the guys and gals that do that out west.
Yeah, it's a profession that you know, they kind of get some recognition now, you know, through the media, but their pay is a constant battle, you know, getting a pay increase. You know, the hot shots and stuff like that, they're constantly battling. You know, it goes to the House and Senate, and the bills, they just don't get passed for them to get a pay raise because they don't get paid nearly enough of what they should for what they do.
Absolutely.
And it's you know, very unfortunate because those people, they're kick-ass people, you know. And
for sure.
It's a lifestyle. That's for sure, man. It's it's an animal. I've seen things that in my short period of time of doing it that, yeah, I mean, it's crazy. It's a crazy life. Life. But anyway.
So when you graduated from Hawking, did you jump into the waterfowl space right away, or did you kind of jump around before taking that role on?
No, I actually worked at a wildlife area not too far from where I lived. You know, it's a woodland type wildlife area where, you know, you're doing, you know, forest game type stuff. I did, I think, a year working there. And then there was an opening at the one wildlife area. So I transferred up there. And yeah, it's been a career, you know, managing for all sorts of things, man. It's crazy.
Yeah.
You never know what you're going to get into.
So kind of walk us through, you know, what your objectives were as far as the waterfowl management and kind of the practices that you guys got into for managing those areas.
Well, that's a good question. It's the thing about the, you know, working at a waterfowl management area, you know, there is still a lot of upland and forest on the wildlife area. So you still have to pay attention to the deer and turkeys and stuff like that. And, you know, doves and, you know, trying to offer as much as you can to the sportsmen that come and utilize the wildlife areas. But, you know, when it comes to waterfowl season, waterfowl management, you know, it kind of starts, you know, it's all year long, but, you know, here pretty soon, here probably at the end of the month, beginning of June, we'll start drawing down our man-made wetlands on that wildlife area for, you know, diversity of species. And we can get in that later, but yeah, you're drawing down, you know, you're flooding, you're doing aerial spraying of invasives, which that's a constant battle. Phragmites, spatterdock, God, and the list goes on that you're just constantly battling. You know, purple loosestrife is another one that we battle. So you're doing aerial spraying, and then you're doing aerial seeding, you know, with a helicopter and stuff like that. And now we've been using drones quite a bit, hiring companies to do drone spraying and aerial seeding, which has been working out great for us as well. But especially the spraying part, because, you know, the wildlife area is very unique, and you kind of can't get the helicopter into certain areas, and that's where the drone comes in to do some spraying to battle those invasives that are constantly plaguing wetlands. Excuse me. So, yeah, and then you're just constantly after that. It's just, you know, you're managing water. It's what you're doing. And, you know, instead of old field habitats and you know, warm season grasses, you're just, you know, you're managing water. You know, right. The water dictates the level is what you're trying to grow or not grow. And which is really cool. It's really neat. And but then you're doing constantly, you know, throughout the winter, you know, you're doing maintenance of water control structures, you know, and redoing some, you know. And right now Ohio has this thing called H2O project where the governor has money allocated, and I don't want to say the wrong thing and butcher it, but basically in a nutshell, there's money allocated to preserving wetlands or creating wetlands. He's put a lot of emphasis on conservation and, you know, put the politics aside, whether you're, you know, Republican or Democrat, this governor that we have in Ohio, again, put the politics aside, he is very pro conservation. And this is a very good project that he's been utilizing. And we've been using those dollars to buy land to conserve wetlands and stuff where we couldn't do that before.
Right.
Yep. So,
as far as drawing down the water, talk about the kind of system that you have in place. Is it like a typical levee with a board system that you remove, or is you pumping it out, or how are you guys managing that?
All the above.
Okay.
Yeah. So, but mostly, you know, we have these AccuDrains, but we're switching to a more of our own type style. But yeah, they're boards. You know, they're a rectangle thing that sticks up out of the ground, and you're just pulling boards, you know, a little bit at a time here. Like I said, at the end of the month, beginning of June, where you're just trying to draw down the wetlands to create, you know, it's a steady, you want a steady decline in water, and that brings up different vegetation for waterfowl later. You know, you're planting a food plot. Let's put it that way.
Right.
You know, by reducing water, you're planting a food plot. That's a good one. I like that. But yeah, so you're just doing that. You're looking for, depends on, you know, some wetlands units will do, we'll try to draw it maybe a little faster to get to mud flats. And, you know, we'll do some aerial seeding of Japanese millet. So you're trying to time it to, you know, I think Japanese millet has a 60-day germination rate, I believe. Don't quote me on that.
Sounds right. Yep.
Yeah.
It's pretty quick.
So you're trying to time it to where, you know, for either teal season or, you know, early season of regular, you know, waterfowl. So you're trying, it's a timing thing, and water, rains, flooding can be a pain. But so, yeah, if it depends on what we're trying to accomplish in that certain unit, whether it's invertebrates, or we're just looking for, you know, a man-made thing, reference seed for them. So sure. That's basically what we're trying to do in those wetland units.
Yep. So besides the seeding and controlling the invasives, what kind of natural plants are you trying to promote? And what do you see the waterfowl utilizing in those natural species?
Yeah, we're trying to create, let's see here, like barnyard millets, smart weeds, rice cut grass. You had to ask me something off the, like those are three that are coming to mind, but there's other species that were a little rusty. That's where that 50-year-old comes in.
Sure.
Yeah, but those three are the, you know, like the main ones that we're, you know, trying to accomplish. And the thing is those wetlands, you know, any type of hydraulic, soils, you know, they have so much seed bank in them, you know, and you get a flush of everything that these waterfowl are using and stuff. And, you know, sometimes, you know, depends on how big of a unit that you have, you know, people are constantly, just like in the deer world, okay, where everybody concentrates on food plots, right? Growing brassicas and clovers and stuff. When sometimes, like an old field type environment, sometimes is usually better. You know, it has everything a deer needs. But in waterfowl, in some cases, the invertebrates are kind of more important. You know, they get those waterfowl, you know, that feeds them great. You know, but if you have a little unit and stuff and you're just planting a little bit of Japanese millet, you know, those blackbirds kind of just clean house before anything. So it's just like a deer over browsing a food plot. Like, oh, we did all that work for what, you know? So sometimes, you know, you're going back to the old school type thing of, you know, actually doing what waterfowl needs, and it doesn't get to the hype because it doesn't make what people any money. So, right, you know, right, trying to create an environment for those, you know, invertebrates, and, you know, they benefit more than just waterfowl, obviously shorebirds, you know, that's part of our management strategy is, you know, attracting shorebirds. And don't ask me, there's a dicky bird and there's shorebirds. That's all, you know, that's, I'm not a necessarily a bird person, a shorebird person, unfortunately. And you would think I would know, but
there's such a variety of them too.
Yeah. There's so much room up there left, but, so you're there's, it's again, it's just, when you do one, it benefits many species, but it depends on what size, you know, the unit that we're managing or the people they're managing their own wetlands is you have to decide what you're trying to accomplish. You know, just like everything else, you know, what do I want my waterfowl to eat? You know, again, not to repeat myself, sometimes, you know, just doing little just because everybody's doing it on social media, you know, planting Japanese millet or buckwheat or, you know, whatever, you know, those non-target species like blackbirds, they'll just clean you out, you know, and then you have nothing, you know, so.
Diversity.
Mm.
Always diversity. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Oh, yeah, sure. One thing I noticed where you work across the border from me here in Pennsylvania, we call a lot of this stuff swamps, and it seems like a lot of stuff you guys work on you call marsh. And I've heard people call marshes all over the United States, but we call them all swamps here in PA. I don't know if we're just dumb hillbillies or if they're interchangeable.
No, it's funny that you say that because where I grew up, it was a swamp. And now, you know, now where I work, you know, we call them wetlands, but then you go up to Lake Erie, they're marshes, you know, it's funny. It's definitely regional on what you use, levee versus dike versus this and stuff like that. Yeah,
sure.
Yep. But, it's depending on where you live.
Yeah. I had a guest on from Kansas and I kept talking about swamps and he's like, you mean marshes?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I think they're the same thing, but I just wanted to double check that before I kept, you know, making the mistake.
It's whatever you want to use, man, whatever you want to use. Yep. But,
So some of these, places that you've worked, they've changed a lot in the last 150 years. I know one that you worked at, they channelized the creek about 100 years ago.
Mm. Yeah.
To improve the area for farming and all that.
Oh, yeah.
So what kind of, I guess we can do the pros and cons of that. Like there's it's necessary. You want to have farmers to have land to feed people. You want to control flooding so people aren't losing their houses and things. But I guess let's kind of walk through the pros of taking an area like that and channelizing it and starting to do the water control, like you talked about with drawing down water and things like that.
Yeah. It's, the creek, the cons of it, there's a lot of pros, like you said to it, you know, and where I work, it's most of it is natural wetlands. Okay. It was glacier formed. And I think there's from the city of Worcester to the town of Millersburg, I think it's only like a 10-foot fall. It's insane.
Wow.
And, you know, the creek, you know, it meandered valley to valley to valley to valley, just snaked from valley to valley, you know, mountain or hillside to hillside. And so what you have is just, you know, wet woods. And then when the beaver came in, you know, they would dam and create these phenomenal wetlands. You know, and like you said, they came in and dredged that out, you know, for farming and, you know, and whatever they were, you know, trying to do. Well, half full, half empty, half full, it created a dike system to where we can now start to manage those natural wetlands with control structures and draw those down and all that stuff instead of creating those construction wise. with dozers and trackos and stuff. All we have to do is just put, control structures in, put a little channel, and we are good to go, and that's, we're in the process of finally doing that. But, with the flooding that occurs, because, when you do have a it's basically a ditch now, you get all this silt load from up north, so it's silting in, and those break those dikes, if you will, the dredging created, so many years ago. So you have cuts, and then when it floods, it just drops that silt load now in our wetlands. So our wetlands now are starting to get a little drier because of the silt load, so we have to go in there, spend, dollars and fix those breaks. And that's not easy to do. Just go in there. The task at hand is very easy, but then we have to go through, Army Corps engineers, and is that a wetland? Is it not a wetland? Okay, what kind of class is in? And that's a rabbit hole for another day. So, we fight. It's a battle trying to get anything accomplished sometimes because of all the permitting and all that stuff, just to fix a break, and all this stuff. So, yeah, sure. You can sit there and criticize and do all this other stuff, but you make hay what you can, and utilize the creek for what it's offering you. The flooding is, there's certain areas where it's so bad now where we get a 2-inch rain, it floods. Yep. Dramatizing a little bit, obviously, but
sure,
you get those soakers, those 4-inchers and stuff like that over a course of a period of time. When up north is all asphalt and concrete, all that water goes into that creek. We're surrounded by, urbanization, and all that water obviously runs off into the creek and drains it, whatever it brings with it. And that's where the invasives come and all that other stuff, so.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah, we're having that issue here too. There's so much development going on. And even in just my neighborhood, there were at least 12 to 14 family farms when I moved here 25 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I think all but one or two are all housing plans now. And there's been no infrastructure set for water management. So we've lost mm-hmm. all this natural vegetation that's filtering water and controlling water. And mm-hmm. like you said, it's all asphalt and concrete.
Yeah.
And this poor little town over the ridge from me just gets killed now anytime we get a couple inches of rain. It's terrible to see.
Yeah. But I know if we didn't have that marsh there, because just as many people that like it, there's some people that don't like it. But if it wasn't for that marsh to hold water, from flooding, south of that, south of the wildlife area, would be, it would be like those pictures you see back in the day, all the flooding, those wetlands are just more than just for recreational use. Those are wetlands are made to store water, store silt, the benefits of wetlands is just incredible. More than just the recreational side.
Yeah.
Definitely storage capability and everything.
Yeah. And we've lost so much of it. And again, like I said, we got a lot of mouths to feed. So I don't blame the farmers for doing what they have to do, but it's sad that, and we've talked about it many times before, not just the wetlands, but the farming practices have become so precise now. We're losing all of our fence rows for the pheasant mm-hmm. and the grouse and everything else. And it's, you'd like to go back, turn the clock back and go back to the time when we didn't have to do all this, but you also have to figure out how to manage it now. I mean, you said it perfectly, like earlier about the grouse, not on our watch. If there's things that we can do, we have to try to mm-hmm. do what we can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's the thing, the future of wildlife management, man, it's a delicate conversation. I don't know if that's the right verbiage for it, but what I mean is that invasives are going to be our world, coming up. So how much money do you want to put forth in controlling that? Or do you just manage a situation? Then you have the social aspect of it. You know, we're losing, you know, science. We're more going toward, you know, the social aspect of things, how people feel about it. You know, that's coming. And we're starting to see signs of that. And then you have, like, you know, you talked about the farms, you know, I mean, I drive an hour to work and all I see is, you know, 444 acres and four parcels. No one wants that. It's the elephant in the room, but no one ever wants to talk about it. You know, parceling up lands, you know, and you can't blame anybody. I mean,
right.
Kids don't, or grandkids don't want to work a farm anymore. So, you know, dad or grandpa, you know, what's, hey, I want to take care of my children financially, and they sell off their ground. You can't debate or argue with someone doing that. But sure. At the same time, for wildlife wise, I mean, come on now, you know, I don't know how you fix it with, incentives not to do that, programs, but then, you know, that brings in the government and money and all this other stuff. Do you want to get involved in that? And that's, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so, yeah, the world of, you know, waterfowl, grouse, even the white-tailed deer. I mean, we're in a heyday right now. We have to remember this time, Brian, because right now things are great, right? In the deer world.
For sure.
It's coming where we're going to be talking about this, maybe not in our lifetime of hunting, that is, but it's coming to where, you know, we'll be talking about these days. Like, remember, yeah. Population wise, habitat wise, you know, the social aspect of it, things, urbanization, not to be all down. That's not my intention here, but it's just like, man,
it's reality. Things, yeah.
You have to think like this. You have to at least have people like myself telling people like this, you know, sure. I'm always the guy in the room that'll bring everybody down, but my God, you have to put this on people's radar. When you're in the marsh, you know, duck hunting and enjoying that sunrise or sunset, and teal are flying 100 miles an hour through your spread, soak that in. Soak it in, man. You know, because you don't know when the last, this might, you know, days are numbered, maybe.
Sure.
We don't know that, but, you know.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Soak it in and start to think about what you can do to help. Don't just be a consumer.
Yeah.
Which I understand people have busy lives now. We both are fathers. We've ran our kids around everywhere, worked full time. It gets hectic. Yeah. But there's something that everybody can do, whether it's even if it's just writing a check. And I don't like to be that guy that just writes the check. I like to try to put a little time in. But even if you're just doing that, at least you're doing something beyond just being a consumer.
Yeah. And again, like with Cody and I, you know, with the Deer Hunter Project, you know, we have this grouse initiative, and, you know, the person that cuts the check, I remember feeling that way. Like, you know, I remember even like not making fun of people. Like, there was a time period where, come on, you can do more than that. But you're absolutely right. That is all you can do sometimes, you know, just to cut a check. Or any more that we're trying to push, it's just be an advocate, because conservationist, you know, it's just not hunting. Hunting is part of conservation, but it's only a third or a quarter of it, you know, financial. Do what I stole this quote from Teddy. Do what you can where you're at, or what you have and where you're at. You know, whatever you can do, you got to figure out a way to do it, whether it's money, time, or just advocating, you know, on social media. Let's bring that in. If you see a Ducks Unlimited post that's really cool, share it. And just because you're sharing it to a bunch of people that you have no idea whether they'll even look at it or click that like button, that's advocating, sharing information
right. That's,
you know, fact-checked and all that stuff, you know, and that's, you know, Joe Blow, you know, hey, this is what I'm doing, but actual, you know, Ducks Unlimited, Delta Waterfowl, you know, and other organizations that deal with wetlands and stuff, you know, sharing their information, that's doing something, you know, instead of, you know, I remember the time, what you remember, and you don't see it as often anymore. You know, people's back of their truck windows had all these decals on it from NWTF to, you know, DU to all of it. That's just for, you know, used to make like fun of them, like NASCAR, you know, they're sponsored by, you know, here, I'm a member now, here's my sticker, and I'll stick on, look at me, I'm a conservationist. But, Yeah, you don't see that as often as you used to. Yeah. I don't, at least. Yeah. You know, that's funny how
people are probably too afraid to give up their spots if they're parked right. Somewhere.
Yeah, no, they get on social. they get on these hunting website. And go, I just slammed my limited teal. Here's right. The thing, and then they complain that there's everybody there yep. The next day.
Yep, exactly.
But yeah, just doing what you can. That's the priority. Whatever yeah. That is, do it. Because sure. We have a friend, Sam Leatherman. He's a guide outfitter. He wears many hats as well. And I remember having a deep conversation with him about conservation, driving down the road one time, and he made a statement, and I told him I'm stealing it from him, because he said, we're running out of somebody else to take care of it.
Yeah.
And that is a powerful statement. Sure is. You know, there's, you know, and it fluctuates depending on the year. COVID, you know, obviously we had a spike in sportsmen and fishermen and trappers, you know, got people outside. But overall, you know, there's 11 and a half million of us. Think about it. That's it. Out of how many? 300 million people we have in this country or something like that.
Yeah. Yep.
Only 11 and a half million of us. And every year, you know, the average age, I think it's like in the mid 50s, you know, and that age class gets older and older. Jeez. And older. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, not to go on a tangent here. I'm sorry, Brian, if I do.
No, please.
Correct me, you know, stop me. But, you know, I was pumping gas. I just got done filming this grouse drumming on a log. And I went to, you know, after that, I went to the gas station, I'm pumping gas, and I looked up and I saw a billboard, and it was from World Wildlife Federation, you know, our friends. Mm-hmm. And it said, love it or lose it, protect our forest. And I could have bit through a nail, because that is you know, the other side is always, you know, they don't have a problem with propaganda.
Sure. You know?
And, you know, subconsciously or, you know, not, you know, people that read that billboard, most people don't, they read it and just go on with their lives. But when they see a log truck drive by or a cut that was maybe too close to the road, and they see the non-aesthetically pleasing aspect of it, they think of that billboard. And I always say, metaphorically speaking, where is our billboard, man? We do more good for wildlife and conservation that we just, like, what are we doing? You know? So, you know, just again, we have to start sharing our story, whether it's waterfowl, whether it's, you know, upland, whether it's deer. Yeah, just not being afraid to say who you are, be proud of who you are and what, you know. And sometimes as well, I strongly believe this. Doesn't mean that I'm right, but the antis, you know, they'll have their wins, but overall, they're not going to be the death of us. You know, they'll have their wins. If you are a member of the Sportsman's Alliance, or if you're not, you can get on their social media, Instagram and Facebook, and you'll see the battles that they are fighting for us, as sportsmen. And, the antis are not going to be the death of us, I don't think. What will be the death of us is us.
Yeah.
You know, we can't seem to get along. No, that's not the right way. We have our differences on how we should manage deer, how we should manage waterfowl, you know, and et cetera. And, yeah, I always tell people, like, that contact Cody and I, like, hey, we want to help out, you know, say things, and it comes off corny, but it's not like, hey, I want to be a conservationist. And I always quick to tell them, like, hey, you better be prepared to be mocked, ridiculed, made fun of, lose credibility from not the antis, but our own side. Because when you're standing up in a room, a crowded room of like-minded people, sometimes you look around and there's nobody else standing, and you got to be strong. You got to just still stand 2 feet and just speak the truth and speak what's in your heart. And it's, you know, and wildlife should always come first, and our personal beliefs second when it comes to managing for wildlife, you know, waterfowl, birds, upland birds, forest game, Salamanders, they don't care if you're black, white, gay, straight. They don't care. They just want taken care of.
Well put. You know?
Yeah. I mean, that's the truth. They just want taken care of, and they don't care what you are, you know?
Absolutely.
So, yeah. But I didn't mean to go on a.
No, I'm glad you did. It's an important topic that doesn't get talked about enough. You and Cody are great ambassadors of keeping that conversation going. And I think it's great that we get the word out. We need more people speaking out, like you said.
But no, it's a, it can be depressing. It can be depressing. I stare up at the ceiling many nights, 2 o'clock in the morning, trying to save the world. And my wife's just like, she'll lean over or she'll look over and there's the phone all lit up. My face lit up from my phone and I'm doing research or an idea popped in my mind. And, you know, it's just that, yeah, it's wildlife. It's the greatest thing, but it'd probably be the death of me by it's over. But anyway.
Well, let's jump back into that.
Yes.
I know you've transferred from waterfowl, concentrating on waterfowl management in your career, but what's the status of the waterfowl? Are the numbers in good shape? Is the habitat in good shape where you're working?
Well, depends on who you ask. That seems to be the thing. If you listen to Ducks Unlimited, you know, they're biologists, there's, you know, lots of waterfowl, and that may be, but we are not seeing the waterfowl like we used to. And whether you believe in climate change or not, which, you know, I think, you know, let's just touch on that real quick. I think majority of the people would agree that the climate is changing, but how we go about fixing the problem or is, you know, the policies and stuff like that is where people have a problem with.
Sure.
So, yeah, I mean, the ducks are not coming down like they used to, you know. They, you know, due to cold weather or, you know, what have you. And, you know, that's just, you know, peaks and valleys, you know, cycles, you know,
right.
Before I know on our wildlife area, you can count on teal being there for opening day and lots of them. And I don't think we've had a great teal, you know, push in a long time, you know, they just don't get pushed down, you know, weather or whatever, you know, somebody else might know another reason for it. But, yeah, it's just, you know, we have ducks and, you know, we get, you know, the locals, you know, that first, you know, opening day of teal season, some, painted teal, they get shot with ducks,
you know,
the local wood duck population sometimes gets hit.
Yep.
But, yeah, so
very important to know your identification. Yeah,
I don't know. Sure. I just don't understand people that like, hey, I want waterfowl hunt, but you don't know the species and there's a 6-bag limit and there's certain species you can have in that bag, you know?
Right.
But yeah, it's, you know, one could say that, you know, is it weather? Is it other situations? You know, I'm obviously weather is a big factor, especially, you know, you talk to people that, you know, snow goose a lot in that late season, you know, in January, February in the Midwest, you know, the true Midwest and, you know, the snow geese, they fluctuate with, storms and snow and weather and cold and all that stuff, you know, you know, one could say that they're it's impacted them, you know,
for sure.
But yeah, it's, you can definitely say, you know, waterfowl numbers are not like what the biologists are saying. When you live in Ohio and the numbers are high up in Canada, you know, not saying the ducks are not there because I'm sure they are, they're professional people doing a great job, but at the same time, we don't see those numbers. Yeah. And again, like Ohio, Pennsylvania, especially, you know, Pittsburgh area, you know, even where I work, you know, we're in a, you know, Mississippi flyway, but we're not in a very good corridor.
Yeah.
You know, and that dictates, I mean, if it wasn't for Lake Erie marshes in the Western Basin, would we have the waterfowl like, you know, we should, sure. You know, probably not, you know? So, I know the spring migration is insane. The fall migration is totally different, right? You know, the number wise, you know, spring migration going back up, it's insane. It's nuts. And someone's going to have to explain it to me, you know, the difference between the two, but, you know,
yeah, and that's interesting. I think,
yeah. And, you know, waterfowl and, you know, I'm sure most of your listeners or people following you are duck hunters, and they know, you know, the number one thing with waterfowl, more so than even white-tailed deer, pressure. Mm-hmm. They do not stand for pressure.
Right.
More so than, you know, than white-tailed deer. They don't like something, they're gone and they're not coming back. You know, when you have a wildlife area or something that just gets pounded all the time or what have you, I mean, they're not going to hang around. They're going to fly south or fly north or, you know, east or west. You know, they're going to find a spot where the pressure. So we can't rule out, you know, that's having an impact because, you know, there's more waterfowl hunters starting to come. Obviously there was very high and then kind of dipped down, but, you know, due to Duck Dynasty and all this other, you know, shows and sure. popularity, you know, people, you know, are starting to take up the sport. And it's funny, they come into the wildlife area and they all look the same. They all look like the beard. It's like, what are you doing? They got a, you know, a boat with a, not a regular motor. I'm just throwing
mud motor.
Yeah, that one of those. They just all went to the same store, man.
Well, you see, you talk about pressure. They got to grow those beards so they're not spotted and not,
yeah,
not putting
right.
any pressure with their
yeah.
faces looking up.
Yeah, that's
yeah,
right.
Yeah, I had to chuckle whenever I was talking to you about starting this podcast, and you're like, "Did you grow a big beard now, or what?"
Yeah, it's like I haven't seen it in a while.
Yeah, five more years, maybe, because I work in law enforcement, so
yeah, you don't need anybody tugging on your beard.
Yeah, I got to stay clean shaven. That's part of our regs, unfortunately. But
oh yeah,
maybe in a couple years when I retire.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Never see, I grow one out and it's just, I look like Santa. It's just white, man. It's just white. My wife hates it.
I can relate to that.
Yeah.
For sure.
But, no, the numbers is, you know, there's ducks. There's plenty of ducks. There's, you know, plenty of geese. I know the sandhill crane population in Ohio is doing phenomenal. I know on our, I think it was last year, beginning of 23, and we have an 800 acre refuge on our wildlife area, and I think there was like 600 or so sandhills flying into roost in the marsh, and where when I first started there was one nesting pair, you know, that's all you would see. Now we're having sandhills just galore, you know, which is, they're far from a huntable population, but my gosh, it's amazing to see that sound, you know, being heard again in Ohio. Trumpeter swans, Trump, you know, due to a lot of people's effort, just not the states, but a lot of conservationists, you know, the trumpeter swans are killing it, man. They're coming back. They got delisted, from endangered. They're doing great. You know, obviously the eagles and ospreys, you know, and when you see indicator species like that, Things are good, despite all the bad that we talked about earlier, you know, the depressing stuff. There's some positive things going on, you know, with species that are river otters. River otters is a great indicator of water quality, you know, mussels, purple cat's paw, you know, those are all great indicator species of water quality and stuff like that. So it's yeah, half full, half empty.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So not being in a major part of the flyway, what kind of species are you seeing on the regular over the 28 years that you've been working there and paying attention?
The coot. The water crow. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can always count on a coot. But now we get, you know, a lot of wood ducks, you know, yeah, teal when they're down is great. You know, wood ducks is great. And then you get your mallards in the late season, latter part, you know, the blacks come in, black ducks and stuff like that. But yeah, you'll see, you know, a whole spectrum of, you know, species. I mean, if you come to Central Ohio, you know, you'll see, you know, Gadwall, you'll see, you don't see a lot of divers, but they're mixed in every now and then.
Sure.
But, you know, cause most of our water's, you know, somewhat, you know, not deep enough for them.
Right.
But yeah, your mallards, you know, you're going to have a good bag. You know, there's days that you're going to have a mixed bag of some goodies for sure.
See many pintails over that way?
Yeah, just latter part. Yeah. You know, the spring migrations when we really see the pintails, you know, and what the difference is. Again, someone,
yeah, that's very
someone
interesting.
Smarter than me.
I'm going to have to look into that.
Yeah, someone smarter than me that's going to be able to explain that. And I'm sure there is an answer to it. But yeah, you'll see. Yeah. I mean, the thing is again, the, you know, like what you have to do, you know, the waterways, the rivers, the creeks. Yeah. I mean, those are some great, you know, you don't have to be stuck out of some wildlife area or whatever. People, I don't think, and I'm not a big duck hunter where I show up at a boat ramp, you know, in the Muskingum River, you know, I'm not there to see it, but just, you know, what you hear and, you know, what you do see, people don't take advantage of that as much. Your diehards do. They know those little honey holes and stuff like that, but man, people, I don't think people take advantage of it as much as they should or could, you know. Yeah, those are some great waterfowl hunting opportunities, you know, our streams and creeks and river systems for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I talk to a lot of people around the country, and they hear I'm from Western Pennsylvania, and they're like, "Where do you hunt ducks there?" And
yeah,
I have
right?
to kind of go through the whole thing about our river systems and our swamps and our, you know, we're fortunate to have Lake Erie, which brings a lot of birds from Canada, and then they just work their way down the river systems and the swamps. So it's not the Mississippi Flyway, but you know. Proper, like they're getting hammered with them, but we get enough coming through here to keep us busy and have fun.
Yeah. It's funny, when I was really diehard into waterfowl hunting, I first started working at the wildlife area. It's funny, we traveled, you know, and we thought we were just phenomenal duck hunters. I think we were doing good, you know.
Yep.
And then as a duck hunter, you know that you have to travel if you want to really enjoy the sport. You're going to have to get your buddies.
A lot of windshield time.
Oh yeah. A lot of windshield time.
Yep.
And sometimes, you know, that's going out of state. And I remember I was fortunate enough to go with a couple guys to Stuttgart, and that was just unreal. And those guys were like, there ain't no, these ducks ain't like they used to be. And I'm like, oh my God, it's raining ducks. Are you nuts? This is crazy. Yeah. But they, you know, back in those days, they were even seeing the, you know, the, things were starting to change a little bit and stuff.
Perspectives.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
You know, flooded timber and all that stuff. But yeah, it's something. But yeah, if you're a waterfowl hunter in Ohio and PA, it's funny. People come into the wildlife area and say, where's the ducks? And I always say, well, Arkansas, Louisiana, Alabama, where you're trying to make a state that's not known for waterfowl, a waterfowl state. I mean, it's called. It is the elephant in the room. That doesn't mean you can't go out and have fun. That's not what I'm saying. But to do it like you treat it like deer hunting and stuff like that, you got, like you said, windshield time, man.
Yep.
You know, windshield, especially with geese. You know, you don't know what field they're in. It's a lot of time, a lot of dedication, a lot of fuel going through your vehicle, you know, trying to find them and get permission anymore to get all that stuff and what have you. But yeah.
Yeah, I asked you for the best teal spots, and you said Lake Erie in Mexico.
Yeah, I did, didn't I? I remember saying that.
That was great.
Yeah. And yeah, I got to have you reach out, and after when we're done, I'll give you phone numbers to people that, you know, they.
Yeah,
I appreciate it. Like my one buddy, he texts me. I asked him so I don't butcher it, and I really want you to have him on to really talk duck hunting, you know.
Sure.
I asked him how many species he's obsessed with ducks, and he's a taxidermist, you know, waterfowl taxidermist, and went to college with him, and he's got more trophies and awards and stuff. He can shake a stick at his waterfowl art is incredible, but he's got, so how many, we were turkey hunting. That's what it was. We were turkey hunting, and he said, well, I got 42 species of waterfowl so far.
Mm.
that he's got every species in North America that offers. I mean, he goes and he's killed the emperor goose in Alaska, and he goes to Mexico and you know, hunts down there, you know, and stuff. But yeah, he's got the slam of North America, basically, of waterfowl. So he knows a little bit about, and he doesn't have the, you know, he's just like you or me, you know, he's not wheeling in money, you know, or he does his work and pays his dues, and he doesn't go to these expensive, extravagant places to make sure that he gets, you know.
That's cool.
But yeah, he does it right. He's a hell of a waterfowl hunter and taxidermist as well. So
yeah, definitely like to get him on and talk tactics. That'd be cool.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yep.
But, well, Eric, I appreciate your time, my friend. I've had you on here for about an hour now.
Really?
Just wanted to give you a chance to tell everybody, you know, what you're working on now, where they could find you and how they can get involved.
Yeah. No, they can, they can find me on social media, mostly on the Deer Hunter Project. And that's where I spend most of my time. If I am on social media, Cody does say he's young. He does all the social media. But no, you can find me there. Very easy. I love people contacting me. I will take the time to take the phone call and talk, whatever. I enjoy talking to people about wildlife and all that stuff. But one thing I wanted to mention too, before we get off, I feel like I should bring this up. If people are, you know, talking about wetland management and, you know, waterfowl management, you know, we kind of briefly talked about it. If you have the you know, the property to do something, do not be afraid to reach out to your state agency, no matter where you live, or the soil and water agency, you know, where you live. If, you know, they'll come out for free. They'll help you look up your soils, see if they are capable of holding water. And there's a lot of programs out there. You could either do it yourself, and or there's programs that help you pay for, you know, wetland construction, where you can, you know, enjoy having that whole thing. Because having a wetland on your property, man, that is absolutely icing on the cake, you know, as a conservationist, because of species that utilizes wetlands. It's phenomenal. I mean, if you're a deer hunter, try to get a wetland, because they utilize those wetlands more than you know. You know, the muskrats and beaver and all that stuff that utilizes, you can have that on your place by simply just checking your soil to see if you can have a wetland on there, you know, if it's capable of holding water is a big key thing. But then, you know, there's a lot of people out there, you know, that doesn't charge, you know, the state agencies usually don't charge the soil and water, you know? But yeah, don't be afraid to, it doesn't hurt. Try it for sure.
Absolutely. So, yeah. That's why I like talking to you and glad that I've got to know you over the years. You always got a mind for conservation and putting the wildlife first, my friend.
Yeah. No, Brian, I tell you what, you're a dear friend. Always appreciate you and what you have accomplished, man. Like, your story is insane. Yeah, I mean, from the first time I met you to this. Yeah. I tell you what, man, you are not afraid to just try it. I love that. Sometimes I get a little nervous. I'm not afraid to try it, but sometimes I get a little, I'll get there. But yeah, no, man, you go from one thing to the next, and that is not in a negative sense. That is just let's go, right. You know, and the roads that you've been down, you should definitely pat yourself on the back. Cause I tell you what, it's the one thing that I resent you and hate you for, to be honest with you, is your physical fitness regime that you post. That I can't stand. And let's talk about that for a while. Why do you got to show off to everybody and make people like me feel lazy and incompetent?
Well, I'll tell you what, it started out as a couple of friends. We were all like trying to hold each other accountable. And then the next thing you know, we get messages from people and they're like, wow, you got me really back into the gym. And I'm like, I'm like the last person you should be taking fitness advice from.
People pay attention.
Yeah.
People pay attention.
It's if you can help somebody, you know, whether it's talking about my faith in God or, you know, my journey through the outdoor industry or fitness, if I can help somebody along the way, that's what it's all about.
Yeah, for sure. It's either hit the gym or come help me build my deck around my pool, because you'll get a lot of squats.
Yeah, you're doing a lot of squats from what you were saying.
Yeah. I want to tell you something. I've been bouncing this off back and forth. I'm writing a script for Cody and I are putting a grouse video out. Mm-hmm. He's up in the Arctic doing his thing, filming. For
you talk about a guy getting stuff done. Jesus. That's all over the world.
Oh, man. Yeah. You got to go film. Shut up. Yeah. No, but it's funny. I'm writing a script and you said believer in God. You know, I've always kind of, you know, been a believer, obviously, in Jesus and God himself. And I'm new to it. And I don't know if it's just the age thing or whatever, but very curious and very, you know, diving, you know, getting it, you know, wake up. You know,
sure.
And I, like I said, I am very new to this. And my wife took me to this, my son and I, and my wife went to Columbus to this elevation worship thing. They're based out of North Carolina. It was like a concert and all this stuff. The music was insane. And this guy, Stephen, I can't forget his last name, preacher, he came and he delivered this message. And it was funny. He was talking, I think it was Matthew 30 to 34. And again, I'm butchering all this, so bear with me. But it's basically he mentioned two blind men. Jesus is walking down the road and the two blind men yell out for him. And the crowd shot them down, telling them to shut up. But they spoke even louder. And a crowd shot them down some more. And Jesus finally said, "What is it I can help you with?" And they said they want a sight. He gave them sight. And that scripture there resonated with me on what, like, we're trying to accomplish in conservation.
Right.
Don't be afraid to stand up and shout, you know, because you will get rewarded. And it's funny that that scripture was spoken, you know, not to go down that road for people that don't believe. But yeah, it's just amazing how, you know what? Yeah. Stand up.
Yeah, he finds a way to speak to you in the language that you're listening.
Yeah, for sure. But thank you, brother. Appreciate you very much. Thanks for having me on. And I'll get you some phone numbers to some people that actually can talk waterfowl better than me.
No, I appreciate it. I didn't know that story of your journey from the beginning. And once I found out about it, I'm like, I got to dive into this a little bit more. So,
yeah.
No, great conversation as always. We need to... We need to do this around a campfire. We keep threatening that every year.
We've been talking about that for a long time. We need to get you, old Al with us around the fire as well.
Sure.
Buy lice seed and stuff. And there's your plug.
Yeah. There you go.
I think I get $50 every time I say his name. Then buy lice seed.
What a great friend he is, man.
He's salt of the earth, man. Yep. That good. I tell you what, don't talk soil with him. Because you'll, if you want to feel stupid, talk to him about soil.
Yeah.
Yeah. I always tell Cody and I, like, you got to talk to us like we're 13 because it's just, it's too much. It's too much.
Yep.
But all right, brother. Take care. It's a pleasure.
Thanks, Eric. Big thanks again to Eric for taking time out of his day to stop by the show and talk a little waterfowl with me. Another good conversation. I hope you all enjoyed it as much as I did. And thank you all so much for tuning in. I really appreciate it. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Migration Waterfowl. We also have a Facebook group for the podcast. Please join us there as well. And if you could, please check out our YouTube channel and subscribe while you're there. Lots of great content coming that way throughout the rest of the year. And make sure you join us every Monday for a bonus Migration Monday video podcast. You can find links to our store on our Facebook and Instagram pages. Check out our shirts, hoodies, hats, thermoses, and coffee over there. And now through the end of July, 10% of everything we sell will go to Delta Waterfowl. If you like what you've heard here, please take a moment and leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Send me a message or email after you leave the review, and I'll mail you a podcast decal. And get out there and enjoy the outdoors, but make sure you seek out a relationship with the one who created everything. Ephesians 6, verses 10 through 12 says, "Finally, be strong in the Lord and in his mighty power. Put on the full armor of God so that you can take your stand against the devil's schemes. For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the powers of this dark world, and against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms." And remember, the migration is coming. Be ready when it arrives. Tune in next week to hear another great guest on the Migration Waterfowl Podcast.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.